The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2013, Adrian LaFrance, who writes about technology for The Atlantic, analyzed her own reporting for gender bias. She found that about 25% of the people mentioned in her reporting were women. Granted, she covers Silicon Valley, world programmer capital, and the male-dominated robotics and AI fields, along with the startup and venture capital scene that flocks around them. But she vowed to get better. 2 years later, she made the same analysis and now has the result. Hello, Adrian.
Hi.
So I'm going to go for the headline first. How'd you do?
Not so good, unfortunately. I found out that women were mentioned or quoted in my stories just 22% of the time.
And Adrian, this is after making a real effort to do it differently. So what are you up against?
You know, when I first did the analysis 2 years ago, I thought that the representation of women in my work would be much higher than 25%. And certainly after actually thinking about it for 2 years, one would hope that it would, you know, get at least a little bit better, not get worse. So I think it shows, first of all, that I need to focus even more on representation in my work, but also just how much of a default it can be for reporters to turn to male sources, to rely on the same institutions, just not to seek out diversity in sourcing as much as they probably should.
You also looked at articles that had absolutely no women at all in them. I think you wrote just under 200 for The Atlantic. But you are covering Silicon Valley, robotics, you know, AI, archaeology, astronomy. Is it fair to say that your reporting reflects the lack of women active in those fields?
I think so. I mean, you know, a lot of my journalist friends sort of come to my defense and say, you know, you're reflecting the world as it is. And that may be true, but I think it's overly generous because there are many, many smart, newsworthy women in the fields that I cover. And though they might not be the people who come up first when you ask someone for a suggestion for a source, or perhaps they're not the lead author of a paper because of, you know, various institutional sexism, it doesn't mean that they're not out there. And in fact, in my article, I sort of put a call out to people mentioning that I was looking in particular for female roboticists for a series of stories I'm working on. And I've been absolutely inundated with awesome suggestions, which is really heartening, but also, you know, underscores how I needed to be doing this sooner.
Mm-hmm. But that's tough when you're on a deadline, right?
Right, absolutely. And you know, another thing that some people have brought up is that there are studies that show that women are less likely to agree to interview requests, that women are less likely to, you know, speak on panels. You know, this comes up sometimes when people lament the relative dearth of women running for office in some cases. But again, I think that's sort of a limited way of looking at it. There are merits to, you know, trying to figure out why that might be the case. But it doesn't, you know, in my opinion, it doesn't let journalists off the hook from continuing to try to have better gender representation in their work.
Well, there has been quite a bit of study on this issue. Is that ratio that you found of male to female in your work consistent with other findings?
It's about average. In fact, my most recent analysis shows I'm slightly worse than average. So across the media, if you look at various reports that have been done, usually there's about a 3-to-1 ratio. So you can expect that the percentage of women mentioned or quoted in stories compared with men is about 25% women, 75% men. And again, you know, my percentage was 22%. So I'm slightly worse than average, but not too far off.
But you did quote one study, I think it was from Wales, that this is in print. However, on camera, women are on camera and photographed and represented in the media much, much more.
Right. And this was a really interesting study as well, because it found that women are represented visually. And if you think about that in the context of how little they're quoted, there's sort of this seen but not heard dynamic, which is also quite troubling.
Well, you are one of the people who's trying to change it, but also admit that you are part of the problem. So as you thought through these articles that you wrote and women weren't represented, you and your colleague and researcher came up with some strategies to actually change it. So what are some of the ways that you might do that?
Well, a couple of ways. One of them is to ask for help, which as I mentioned, I did, and so far it's been working great. So really just, you know, as a journalist, if you're talking to a source who happens to be a man who's really helpful, maybe mention, you know, I'm also looking for really smart women who can reflect on this. And oftentimes they'll have lots of great ideas. So that seems like a really easy and straightforward way. Also just sort of taking the extra time to cultivate sources along your beats, your coverage areas, who are women. So, for example, one of the things I reflected on when I did this last analysis was that when I think about the coverage areas I focus on most, and I think about the sort of go-to sources I have, like, you know, some sort of news breaks related to net neutrality, and who am I going to pick up the call, who am I going to pick up the phone and call first, very often that person is a man. And so that to me highlights an area where I need to really focus on cultivating more relationships with sources who are women. Because as you mentioned before, journalists work on a deadline. And in addition to trying to do, you know, the best and most comprehensive reporting we can do, the clock ultimately is a lot of what dictates the decisions we make. And so knowing the people to call in that moment when you know you have to do something quickly is huge.
I wonder for you, Adrian, now that you've been through this and looked at this, you know, twice in your reporting, do you have a little more sympathy or understanding for the firms who do say they just can't find female programmers? Is that still valid?
Not really, frankly. I mean, if anything, it makes me feel worse about myself. And part of the reason why I wanted to do this analysis is I do cover diversity in tech. And reflecting on, you know, I had 2 years ostensibly to improve. And now the way I see it is, okay, like maybe it's forgivable that I didn't make progress the first time around. But by the next time I do this analysis, you better believe I'm going to improve.
Okay, you're going to check in 2 more years?
Absolutely.
Well, we'll love to hear it. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Adrienne LaFrance, she's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers technology, and she's analyzed her own articles and the gender bias within them. You'll find a link to some pretty interesting charts at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As March Madness ramps up, you'll likely be seeing the faces of Donald Trump, Taylor Swift, and Kanye West among the throngs of college students in the stands. Huh? Well, from sporting events to campaign rallies to parades, the foam finger is out and giant heads are in. Famous faces blown up beyond life size and hoisted by cheering fans were designed to distract the opposing team. They also attract cameras like moths to a flame. Zach Schonbrunn is a New York Times contributor, where he wrote about the now ubiquitous giant heads at sporting events. Zach, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So where did these giant heads get their start?
You know, it started more than a decade ago, actually. It really got its initiation from some students at San Diego State University. They have had a very well-known student section there at San Diego State behind the hoop, attempting to distract free throw shooters from opposing teams. And around 2002, a couple students decided, well, why don't we create something new? And they printed out large foam heads with the picture of Michael Jackson on the face of it, and they just held them up in the stands. I don't think they made much motion or really did much, but I think, you know, it obviously caught the attention of the free throw shooter, being so out of the ordinary. And from there, it just grew and grew.
So why so popular at college basketball games in particular?
You know, I think college basketball games, it's a different environment than most sporting events. First of all, you have students who are there attending the games in large populations, and their proximity to the court is much closer than other events, including college football. So I think that tends to create more of a entertaining, exciting environment, and obviously students are always up to new tricks and the latest and best way to stand out. You know, I also think that students try and get on television, and this was one way for them to make themselves known for the cameras.
Yeah, I guess Kim Kardashian's giant head at a game in the stands would do it. You said they started at San Diego State, but Marquette seems to have really embraced the trend, or maybe even helped fuel it.
Yeah, Marquette was one of the first programs that actually, as an athletic department, took it upon themselves to create these big heads and distribute them amongst the fans there. I think, you know, they wanted some amount of control to be able to make sure that they know what heads are going to be in the stands and make sure that nothing inappropriate is there. But they also, you know, they have a very close relationship with their students. They know how much of an impact students can have on the game. You know, around 2005, one of their assistant athletic directors saw these cutouts from a picture in a magazine of San Diego State, and they said, well, why don't we try this? They bought a jigsaw, put it into the basement of their athletic department, and started creating big heads. And they've really made it a real student-generated, you know, system. They have a website where students can go and submit ideas for big heads that they want to create, and then those heads get distributed at games. They have to give away their student identification cards as sort of a collateral to make sure that the big heads get returned to the athletic department at the end of the game. But it's become a very well-known tradition.
Yeah, I guess a sort of enterprising option as well. But these are not just for sporting events. Where else are they popping up?
Well, you know, you've seen them all over the place, really. I mean, concerts are certainly a popular one. You know, bachelorette parties, I understand, have gotten to be popular for creating big heads. But, you know, what you're starting to see this year more and more are political rallies. And so we've seen Trump heads. We've seen some Bernie Sanders is another popular one. So, you know, it's really just up to your imagination. There's almost no limit to where you can find these big heads to start to pop up.
Well, I guess if you've got somebody with a really big hat in front of you, that can be annoying enough. Do you think there's any amount of time before there's going to be some protocol or decorum about waving big heads in front of the person behind you?
You know, I think that's probably going to have to be policed from person to person. It's a good question. I myself have not been seated behind any big heads, but I can imagine it could be a little frustrating. I think for the students, it's just part of the environment, and they've come to kind of accept it as being a real integral factor in how you support your team during the games. Generally speaking, they wave them during free throws when you don't really have to be paying close attention to what's happening on the court. But we'll see. You know, I think that the trend seemingly has only gotten stronger and stronger, and the popularity continues to grow. So obviously people aren't too upset by them.
Well, Zach, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Zach Schoenbrunn, he's a contributor at the New York Times. We've got a link to look at his article, In This Crowd, It's Okay to Stare. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. American colleges and universities are fertile ground for NBA recruiters, but not the only game in town. Among last year's NBA lineup, more than a fifth of the players were born outside of the United States. And these guys don't just show up on the league's doorstep swaddled in size triple extra-large blankets. Most have been on the radar since they were barely old enough to dunk. And that's thanks to a global army of basketball gumshoes scouring the planet for talent. Sam Amedu is a foot soldier in that army, and this story comes to us from producer John Miller as part of the Working series from Homelands Productions.
Sam Amedu has come to Kano in northern Nigeria, near the edge of the Sahara Desert, for a regional high school basketball tournament. 3 days of tall, skinny teenagers slashing and hacking in a hot little arena. He sits at the scorer's table, taking notes.
Coming in here right now, I can tell you that two players interest me so far.
Amedu has an eye for talent, but it doesn't take an expert to notice the two best players on the floor.
The number four stands out because he's tall, he's big. He's rebounding well, he has been out rebounding anybody. He has been boxing out, and he has a very good gait and a very good structure.
Same goes for another kid on the same team who looks a lot like him. Turns out they're brothers, Moses and Paul, 6'6" tall. Everything's going fine until their team starts winning and an angry crowd gathers at the table.
They are saying number four has graduated from the school. So they will now write a protest, we'll look at their evidence. If it is true, then we will disqualify the team.
The team is disqualified, Seems the brothers aren't graduates, but ringers from another school entirely. Still, when the tournament's over, Amedou takes their names and numbers, says he'll be in touch. After all, it wasn't their fault that the coach let them play. Sam Amedou believes in basketball's redemptive power. He says the game saved him from becoming a rascal.
I feel God has been very, very kind to me by using basketball to shape my own life. I got an education, I'm a lawyer, all because of basketball.
For 40 years, Amedou's been playing or coaching or managing teams, but he always had a day job as a lawyer in the Nigerian army. Then in 2005, the NBA's Memphis Grizzlies offered him $10,000 a year to be their eyes and ears in Africa. Nike, always on the lookout for rising stars, kicked in another $7,500, so he went into basketball full-time.
Whether they pay me or not, and they ask me to do those jobs, I will still do it anyway, because it's my passion.
But a scout's life ain't easy.
Ladies and gentlemen, before takeoff, we'd like to acquaint you with our airline safety regulations. Please watch the following demonstrations carefully.
Amedou spends about half his time on the road, not just in Nigeria, where he lives, but in Senegal, Congo, South Africa, Chad. A couple of weeks before I met him, he landed in the hospital, completely worn out.
Well, by name, it may sound like a glamorous job. In reality, it's a difficult job. It's a job that you will work your ass off like a houseboy.
Good pass. Good job. Good look.
It's not like it's hard to find tall people in Nigeria. There are seven-footers everywhere. But the country hasn't had an NBA star since Hakeem Olajuwon back in the 80s and 90s.
50% speed. Slow down.
Back home in Lagos, Amedou drops by the national stadium to check out the junior national team, and I sit down with Abel Baraya, 19 years old. He's a good student. He says he wants to study IT in the States. I ask him if he sees basketball mainly as a way to let him do that.
I still want to make it to the NBA. That's the dream of every player. That's the crest of basketball. That's the peak of basketball.
Do you feel you have a good chance?
Of course. Of course, I would make it any day. I don't feel timid about myself, about my game. Lots of self-confidence, lots of self-esteem.
Lots of self-confidence, lots of self-esteem. That's the mantra here at the Warriors Basketball Academy in an industrial neighborhood in Lagos.
You can do it. Don't worry.
Sam Amedou founded it back in the 1990s.
I know you are thinking that a lot of the players will laugh at you. Right? The point is that every player that becomes great starts somewhere. Let's go.
Academy is a fancy word for it. It's just a bathroomless bunkhouse and this outdoor court. It's all free, all volunteer. Kids show up at 7 in the morning before the day gets too hot. Amedou buys them all breakfast and dishes out advice.
Lady, what position do you think you will end up playing?
I'll end up playing as a 3 and 4.
Why do you think you have the ability to end up as a 4?
I have the ability to end up as a 4 because of my height and the inside play.
Olaide Jubril is 16 years old and already 6 feet 8 inches tall. A prep school in Boston just offered him a scholarship. He sees himself playing as a big man, a forward. Amedou tells him he should work on his ball handling so he can also play guard.
You will be sure that you will make any team. But if you are 6'8 and you want to play as a 4, you may have all the skills, but the likelihood is that you may be limited when you come against them big guys. So start thinking about it. Huh?
None of Amedou's protégés have made it to the Grizzlies yet. One kid from his academy was drafted by the Seattle Supersonics and banged around the league for a couple of years. Others are playing in Europe and Asia, but more than 30 players he's worked with have gone on to high school or college in the States.
If you want to talk about the number of kids that we have reformed, let me put it that way. It is amazing. We have taken people that had lost hope in life, drug addicts, we have brought them to the basketball court. They are now looking after themselves and their own family. They may not play in the NBA, but they have been able to use basketball to get education in life, which is the most important thing.
One result of the NBA's global push is that kids all over the world now go to bed each night and dream that they can make it. But the competition is beyond intense. There's a tiny number of openings, and of course, the bigger the applicant pool, the worse any single player's chances. Kids from Africa are at a disadvantage anyway. There's hardly enough money for backboards, let alone weights and videos and special diets. Sam Amedu understands all that, but he says he doesn't mind. It's better than they're not dreaming at all.
That was John Miller reporting, and a little update to Sam's story. He was elected president of the Africa chapter of the International Basketball Federation. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This weekend, Batman and Superman will face off in multiplexes across America. It will be, as the trailer promises, a classic setup.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. God versus man. Day versus night.
And if you choose to side with man over God, that would be Batman. But which Batman? The scrappy guy bent on avenging the death of his parents at the hands of criminals? The smarmy playboy played by Adam West on TV? The brooding Dark Knight who growled his way through the 1990s? In nearly 80 years of fictional life, Batman has reflected the aspirations and anxieties of America's changing culture. He is, as Glenn Weldon observes, a bat-shaped Rorschach inkblot for us to project meaning upon. And among the most influential projectors of bat personality, nerds. Glenn Weldon is an author and panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. His new book is called The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture, and it charts the evolution of Batman along with the growing influence of nerds on the mainstream. Holy Batman, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Virginia. It's great to be here.
So who was the original Batman?
Well, he doesn't look too different from who he is today, but he only lasted about a year. He premiered in 1939, and for about 11 months, he hopped around rooftops of what was then New York City in a bat getup. He was basically a ripoff of the Shadow, the very popular radio and pulp novel character. There were a lot of ripoffs of the Shadow running around comics back then, and he wasn't even the only bat-themed one. But that just made him a very violent Avenger of the Night who basically killed a lot of the folks that he was up against. He developed a reputation very quickly for tossing goons off of roofs to their deaths. That didn't last long, though, because comics were for kids. And as soon as Robin was introduced, about a year later, he fundamentally changed.
So Robin began after the war. So did this lavish millionaire lifestyle. And so later did the introduction of Batgirl. Why was that? What was the perceived appeal of all of those attributes?
Well, as soon as Robin was introduced, and again, he was introduced only about a year afterwards, sales doubled. Because, A, he lightened the tone, and the parents' groups were starting to get worried about Batman. They were starting to get worried that he was killing all these folk. So they introduced Robin to, A, lighten the tone, and, B, to give kids, who were then the primary audience, somebody to identify with. And that doubled sales. It also gave him somebody to kind of work against visually. You know, red and green pops if you're up against a guy who is in very dark clothes. It also turned him from a very violent vigilante into basically a cop in a cape, a very smiling, happy-go-lucky kind of time traveler and space adventurer. Because for about those 30 years after he was introduced, comics were totally for kids. So they introduced all of these other aspects, the Batgirl, the Batape, the Batwoman, the Batdog in the 50s and 60s, because frankly, people were worried about Batman and Robin. They thought something was up between those two guys. And for a period of time in the mid-50s, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Frederick Wortham famously attacked the comic industry for what he saw as its role in fostering juvenile delinquency. And when he testified in front of Congress and in a book that he wrote, he basically said, what's up with Batman and Robin? He said, Superman is kind of a fascist. He said, Wonder Woman looks to me like a lesbian. And there's something going on here between these two men who hang out in this amazingly sumptuously appointed mansion. So as soon as that registered, the publishers of Batman started throwing all these other people into the mix so that instead of being the most famous double act in comics, they became part of an ensemble.
And the ensemble was on full display in the television series. Should I be ashamed to admit that was my Batman, the Adam West Batman, Glenn?
Virginia, it's my Batman, too. I grew up watching reruns of that show. And, you know, there's a lot of nerds, and I talked to plenty of them for this book, who revile that show because it doesn't take Batman seriously, which is the refrain you're going to hear a lot. I argue in the book that that was its whole mission statement was to take Batman seriously. They took the 60s comics, which, again, were not particularly complex and were made for very young children, which had a very simple, implacable, silly approach, and they said, let's put this onto the big screen. Let's just cut and paste it. So we're going to put it onto the television screen, but we're not going to distort it. We're not going to make fun of it. All we're going to do is say, let's just pretend like this is the most serious Ibsen play we are presenting in the world. And doing that made it hilarious, made it funny. That show touches on something very important about this character, which is you can look at Adam West dancing the Batusi on the go-go floor, and you can look at Christian Bale, you know, kind of saying, swear to me, being very brooding, and you can tell that these are the same character. And it's not because of how they're dressed, and it's not because of what they do, it's because of why they do it. The motivation for this character is the key to his appeal, I think.
And also key to that transformation was nerd culture. This is a big part of the book, of course. You admit to being a nerd and a Batman fan, and that's something that came very clear to you when you were lining up to get a collectible Batmobile at Comic-Con in 2013, which I guess was kind of a turning point for you. What happened?
Well, I mean, that's when it was the first Comic-Con I had been to. It is, if you haven't been, it is overwhelming, pleasantly so. I looked around and saw a lot of smiling faces. I saw a lot of my people, but I also saw a lot of kind of cynical exploitation of my people, and you have to kind of come to terms with that. So, yes, I waited in line for an hour and 45 minutes to plunk down $60 for this chunk of extruded plastic that's the form of the 60s Batmobile, because I do feel a very passionate love for that series. That series, the 66 series, turned him into a public joke and was a huge fad. And then in 1970, the makers of Batman comics said, we need to do something. So they created a Batman who was the antithesis of Adam West, a polar opposite. He was mysterious, he was dark, he was brooding. And most importantly, and this is why I think the appeal to nerds is such a huge part of this character, they made him a nerd. They made him obsessed. And the readers of comics at that time were older than they were even 5 years before. They were teens and adults now, before they were kids. And these teens and adults collected their comics, bagged and boarded them, kept them pristine and away from sunlight. And at conventions, they would talk and debate over whose butt could get kicked by whom. And they would pore over this material as, like they were doing Talmudic study. They were obsessed as well. And I argue in the book that there's a resonance there, that we nerds recognize something in Batman that we don't necessarily recognize in other superheroes.
Who is your Batman? Maybe you came to know the Adam West character on television. Maybe you're a big fan of Christian Bale and Michael Keaton and others who played the Dark Knight. We're talking about how Batman as a character has evolved and accepted the projections of our culture, especially nerd culture, with Glenn Weldon. He's an author and NPR pop culture critic. His new book is called The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. So you have this burgeoning nerd culture, speaking with each other and creating a culture around Batman, but also influencing the trajectory of Batman that's picked up on by Tim Burton, for example, Christopher Nolan, this dark Batman. How does nerd culture feel about the rest of mainstream catching on, and especially these films? You had some pretty funny notes about what people had to say.
Well, sure. I mean, you can go on to, I found some fanzines back in the day that talked about how nerds were always suspicious of the thing that they loved being taken out of the medium that they loved, the comic book, into another medium, whether that was television or movies. And it's very interesting to see how much Hollywood has learned about nerds. Back in the Tim Burton era and the Joel Schumacher era especially, these directors would come to this material and say, yeah, this is kind of silly. I'm going to dispense with this convention and this convention and this convention. And that engendered a huge backlash. People were up in arms over the casting of Michael Keaton in that Batman film. They wrote in, they had petitions. They came close to boycotting the film. Of course, they didn't, because at the end of the day, what nerds want, what we all want, is validation. The fact that the mainstream accepts this thing means that all of a sudden, this thing that we have prized in our own little way out of the in the darkness at the edges of the culture is now as publicly accepted as sports. And that's a new experience for us. So by the time the Christopher Nolan films came around, Hollywood studios had learned their lesson. And they made sure that everybody in that cast and in that crew could quote chapter and verse of which comics that those films drew from. And that made nerds feel very, very protective of the Christopher Nolan films. All of a sudden, they felt like these were ours. And that also leads to the downside of nerd culture, which I do touch on in the book, this toxic aspect of it. When the very first criticism came out of one of the Batman films that was less than a rave, and it wasn't a pan, it was basically just saying, eh, this isn't for me, that guy, that critic, got death threats because nerd culture circled the wagons. So we've gone from being on the outside and critiquing Hollywood to many of us defending Hollywood against the critical establishment.
Well, it's not just the nerds, of course, that are passionate about Batman, but the norms. Many people, as you point out, consider him to be a relatable figure. I mean, he wasn't bit by a radioactive spider. He's a regular human being. He's not a god, which sets him apart from other superheroes. But you also point out that that's kind of ridiculous in a way. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I talked to a lot of nerds, and I heard over and over again that, you know, Superman is entitled. He has these gifts that he had nothing to do with, and he's super powerful, and he can do anything. But Batman's my guy. Batman is human. He's relatable. And I would point out to them, politely, that he has a superpower that you seem to be overlooking, which is wealth. This unimaginable, vast, limitless wealth, which makes anything possible. It explains away all the headquarters, the gadgets, the ride, the costume, everything about him. It works essentially in any given Batman story as magic. And as soon as you acknowledge that, I think you understand this character a little bit better. But I think that there's something about that, Virginia. I think that in America, at least, everybody feels like we could become a billionaire if we just try really hard. So we look at a character like Batman, and the fact that he is separated from us by billions and billions of dollars doesn't necessarily register.
Also, there are so many gritty, dark interpretations of Batman that are really popular now. But one of the things you point out in the book is that he is motivated by hope, not revenge. So why all the darkness?
Because there's this old saw, Virginia, that the comics you read and loved as a kid are the comics that stay with you. And, you know, the best comics in the world, if you ask anybody, are the comics they were reading when they were 12. And I think that there is, if you look at this character and see only the grim, gritty, ultra-violent machismo, you're getting the view of this character that the fanboy has, the adolescent fanboy has. But the important thing about Batman is not that. The important thing about Batman is that when this terrible blow is dealt with him, and I'm talking about the origin, which we've all seen way too many times by now, but when his parents are killed, he doesn't go after the mugger. What he does is he transforms this terrible act, this trauma, into an act of self-rescue. He devotes his life to not just going after that guy, but to stopping crime, to ensuring that what happened to him can never happen to anybody else. He's dedicated himself to this idea of never again, which is a very childish notion. It's a very unrealistic notion. But again, superheroes exist on the level of ideals. They are things to which we aspire. We identify with them, sure, but they work on an emotional and a psychological level.
Well, your observation is that the Batman character goes through these cycles of light to dark pretty much generationally, like 30-year cycles. So maybe we're hitting peak grid, and you think it might turn back?
I think that's inevitable. I think, you know, I haven't seen the Zack Snyder Batman versus Superman film yet, but it certainly seems like he's motivated by the notion of this grim, gritty guy who can beat up folk a lot. And that's a part of him, and that is something that really in the 90s became huge. But there's more to him than that. And the fact that you're seeing DC Comics and a lot of other people making fun of the Batman persona in the Lego movies. Will Arnett plays Batman as a guy who is obsessed with darkness and death metal. The fact that we are now making fun of Batman, not because he's square, as we did in the 60s, but because he is so serious, I think is growth. And I think that is inevitable, that we're about to see a changing of the cycle.
Okay, Glenn, you going to tell us your pick? You've also written a book about Superman, Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. You can look at this on one level as the ultimate jock versus nerd fight, right? Jock has the raw power. Superman's got, you know, the abilities, the strength. Batman has the gadgets, the strategy, the cunning. So in any battle between jock and nerd, I am definitely on Team Nerd.
Glenn Weldon, good to know where you stand. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Glenn Weldon, he's a writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Village Voice, among others. He's also a panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour and author most recently of The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. We've got a link to more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Batman is not the only character to reflect Americans' hopes and fears. Coming up, we're going to hear the story of two heroes fighting problems that felt much closer to home for many in the 1970s. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth returns. Comics have changed significantly since Batman began protecting Gotham back in 1939. By the 1960s, people were more attuned to the social upheavals taking place on the streets, far from the comic book universe, and sales hit a slump. Backstory producer Andrew Parsons has the story of two heroes who helped lead the charge to more socially conscious comic books.
In early 1970, Denny O'Neil walked into DC Comics for his weekly editorial meeting. DC was the home of Batman and Superman. But when he got there, his editor put a different hero on the table.
He said, in effect, that the Green Lantern book was floundering. So he asked me if I had any ideas.
The answer was yes. At 30 years old, O'Neill was part of a new generation of comic writers filling the places of pioneers who had been promoted to editors. And this new generation was young enough to be part of the highly political counterculture protesting the Vietnam War. But protests weren't really O'Neill's style.
I was never going to be a fiery leader and, overthrow the man. But I felt I should do something, and I had access to comic books, and I had had been given a blank slate.
Green Lantern had been created in the early 40s and was basically an intergalactic cop. To Denny O'Neil, he was an establishment guy, always busy fighting villains in other galaxies for an ancient alien police force. So O'Neil decided that the series would bring Lantern down from space and educate him about what was going on in America. Racism, drugs, violence, pollution. But he also wanted a more anti-establishment voice of justice, so he revived another 40s superhero, one that looked a lot like Robin Hood, Green Arrow.
Green Arrow represented the counterculture. For him, authority would damn well have to prove itself.
But what really made the Green Lantern-Green Arrow alliance different was the villains. Previously, Green Lantern had fought powerful aliens and mad scientists. One of his nemeses had a bulging, oversized brain with telekinetic powers. Denny O'Neil's new portrait of evil looked quite a bit different.
He's overweight. He sneers. He smokes a big, smelly cigar. And he reeks arrogance.
The bad guy he's describing? A slumlord. In the series' first issue, an evil inner-city building owner named Jubal Slade is trying to evict African-American tenants. At first, Green Lantern sides with him, only to be called a Nazi by Green Arrow. But Lantern's eyes are eventually opened.
And one of the people who lives in this ghetto is saying, "I've been reading about you, how you work for the Blueskins, how on a planet someplace you helped out the Orange Skins. He'd done considerable for the purple skins, only the skins you never bothered with, the black skins. I want to know how come. Answer me that, Mr. Green Lantern. And in the last panel, Green Lantern with his head bowed saying, I can't. And the rest of it is Green Lantern going against this slumlord.
But that doesn't mean he uses many superpowers. After the slumlord hires men to kill the two superheroes, Green Lantern and Green Arrow team up with the local district attorney to help take Slade down.
That kind of set the tone for the rest of the series.
Honestly, when I read this issue, it struck me as kind of like an after-school special. A bit cheesy and oddly overt. There is a bunch of action and adventure, but Green Arrow is also prone to these mini speeches about injustice. In one, he starts out with a line about how a good black man was killed in Memphis and a good white man in Los Angeles. Here's Denny O'Neill describing the rest.
Something is wrong. Something is killing us all. Some hideous moral cancer is rotting our very souls. In the background behind Green Arrow is Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy.
Well, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow series got a lot of attention.
This is historian Bradford Wright. He wrote a book on the history of comics.
The mainstream press ran a lot of stories on it. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek. And the term that came out of this, coined by the media anyway, was relevance, to characterize these comic books that had, quote, grown up.
The series wasn't the first in the relevance trend, but Green Lantern, Green Arrow possessed more gall. It was directly calling out authority figures for acts of injustice. And it didn't take long for politicians to recognize the utility of comic books for their own messaging campaigns. New York City Mayor John Lindsay bought a page in DC Comics, and the Nixon administration asked Marvel to put an anti-drug message in Spider-Man, a message Green Lantern and Green Arrow were quick to pick up on.
And not too subtly. You had on the cover of Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Speedy, Green Arrow's sidekick, shooting up with heroin. And Green Arrow discovers that his sidekick is a junkie.
Though the series had critical acclaim, it only lasted a few years. By the mid-70s, the industry was ready to move on.
One day I came in and we were not going to do the book anymore.
I think there was kind of the sense of what comic book superheroes are really supposed to do had been a little bit muddled during the whole relevance trend. Essentially, I think comic book makers had concluded that their readers wanted less proselytizing and more punching from their superheroes.
In other words, superheroes had kind of stopped being superheroes. These days, Green Lantern's still around, but he's flying without his liberal partner and is battling outsized supervillains again. In the 2011 Green Lantern movie, one of the members of the intergalactic Green Lantern Corps warns of an evil life force that's
an enemy we don't yet fully understand. We do know it's powerful enough to destroy entire civilizations.
It's a far cry from the villains of the relevance trend, where bad guys were recognizable people with recognizable agendas. Now, in the age of the war on terror, government surveillance, and the Great Recession, maybe we're just more comfortable with villains in the shadows, ones we don't fully understand.
And our thanks to Backstory producer Andrew Parsons for that story. We are always grateful for your time, so thanks for listening. And you can listen on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you enjoy the podcast, rate it on iTunes, which bumps us up in the rankings and helps others find it. And our discovery is just so much more interesting when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.